have a couple, like maybe, I don't know if it's not advice, but suggestion maybe based on our experience of developing, maybe in kind of a naive way, but our own software to support those, you know, so-called activity-based models. And here we say that there are two sides, like really conceptual behavioral side and the software implementation.
Yes.
In reality, actually, it's not two sides. You have three sides. There is one invisible between them that most of the people don't talk about this because it's difficult. But actually, there is a mathematical part, this meaningful description of the algorithm. So one thing is behavior, which you observe.
Sure.
You have people, you have cars, whatever. You can talk about this. You can have service. Translation, then everything has to be translated into a compact, you know, manageable mathematical structure. That normally a lot of people go away because, and then actually you can't jump from the meaningful part, from the conceptual part to the software. That's mistake that we made. When we started doing, we thought we will create objects, basically classes like households, persons, starting with, very quickly, and actually we had a very good idea in mind, and we've been doing this for 10 years, how these models look like, and people like me, like I'm a mathematician by my background, so I know what I'm trying to do. Actually, we learned over the years that the software structure of the software does not correspond to, and this is a naive way. That's what my that's what object-oriented Microsoft publications for housewives say, your program would look exactly like reality. It's not like this, at least in our business.
Right.
And there is a reason for that. Because your software structure have to support the structure of your mathematical calculations rather than the real world. So objects that we have and the classes that we have, and where is the fight, for example, talk about runtime. Do you have a clear idea? You know what really takes 99, why is it so long? And
if you give me an algorithm, I'll tell you what it takes.
Yeah, but I can tell you, we have all the studies. It takes so long, one reason. We really need a better handle on dealing with complicated choice models. We're talking about millions of individuals. Each of them has, you know, thousands of alternatives. And the error term structure might be pretty complicated. So there is a mathematical problem.
Your point's very well taken.
Yeah, so that's where I have to focus. We need a good, what we call a good, for example, logic model class. That's I've been investing for the last like 5 years in our group. Having a good logic model, that's what I need, not a destination choice.
Yeah, we've thought this ourselves. That you know,
I think it's going to be more or less basic for what we are doing. Instead of, you know, this transaction of giving you a prepackaged solution, give you a bunch of kind of underlying algorithms. And, you know, I'm coming also from math world, and, you know, I'm from linear algebra world. And we have this example of LAS, it's a linear algebra package and LayPack. And everybody, you know, who's doing any numerical analysis using those packages, because it's a very efficient data structures and underlying arguments, you know, matrix manipulations, multiplications.
But there are some, again, you understand what you're saying, but those are general things. I'm talking about there are very specific mathematical structures associated with travel. You have to tackle them.
Who work on, like, fluid dynamics, you know, they work with finite elements, and that's convenient for them. The transportation community, we're talking about different algorithms and different data structures, and that's what we have to look at. And, you know, give probably something similar to what, you know, exists in terms of, you know, linear algebra world for transportation community.
The thing that I want to clarify before I get too far away from it is that I wouldn't say what we're doing is object-oriented programming. It's sort of an additional level of abstraction above that.
I understand. It's just an example.
We don't obligate the data structures until the very end. So.
And let's say there are some other examples of really bottlenecks, for example, shortest path building in a large network. That's something. If it had been possible to resolve those two issues, efficient, really, choice models handling, and handling shortest path, everything else is combined largely of those things. But this creates 99% of runtime. So basically, focus on this one, then it's going to be useful, really. But you need a professional who will tell you all those things and basically create those structures for you. Otherwise, I'm not sure how you can really make progress, guys. Because it looks to me very general what you are doing.
Yeah.
And the problems are really very specific and mathematical. So you really need this. So probably have to hire somebody, or if you rely on your own experience. But transoms people, they actually failed exactly on that. They learned too late what is really difficult and what is specific, and they learned it too late.
Okay, our discussion is mainly now on software and general employers thing. Do we want to go back to talk about a little about the integration? That was actually the title of the workshop, and we are not talking anything about the integration issue. But before going there, Kostas said that you have one small
talk. It's not about integration. It's integration with people.
Okay.
it's just one comment. It has a lot to do with the transims experience. I still believe the transims idea was wonderful. I'm very glad that Tom Larson gave $20 million to Latin because it woke up a lot of the old-timers in transportation to start thinking harder and faster. And that's why we see micro-simulation today. And if you don't believe it, go back to 20 years ago papers and you'll see that they were logic models. So something the transims did.
It was easier to write paper.
Yeah. But they did not learn one thing about communication. And people are starting to think, are they competing with me? Oh no, are they going to give it out for free? They pay me to do all these things. Or are you going to have everything that my model has? I spent 20 years writing the code. What are you doing here? So one suggestion I have, since I like your idea, is to explain to different persons in our community that actually you're not competing with the same type of things. You're complementing and you're giving great ideas and great information. Yeah, of course, other people will say they know how to do it and they've got it.
We just want to make sure you sit
down. They're just trying to fool you. So, no, I think this is a good idea, and I'm ready here to learn as much as I learned from transits.
Yeah, I'll give you a different perspective.
Sure.
Things like transits and lots of other publicly funded software projects turn out to be really great for us as a commercial developer because it freezes the market and keeps all the weak sisters from doing it. And it's a very interesting, ironic thing. But one has to live in the environment as it's presented.
Ideas of micro-simulation actually were first showed up in research works in Europe in late 70s and early 80s, before the transit.
Peter, I'm aware of my dissertation is on micro-simulation.
Yeah, but it's not true to say that transit was any kind of generator.
No. It came as a nuclear bomb, no pun intended, in the middle of major universities that did not have micro-simulation in their research plans.
Kostas, do you ever see Integration from Michael Van Aart? It was a beautiful piece of simulation work. It pre-existed transims. It outdistanced it in every possible way. You're being too kind.
To who?
To the people who tried to conceptualize the way to revolutionize stuff. A lot of big ideas.
Yeah,
were there way before.
And some people will say the Club of Rome had the great ideas in the 60s, and then everything was derived from them, simulation. The bottom line is, I was here. I was in the United States in 86, 87, when transims was funded, and I can tell you who were the leaders at that time in TRB presenting papers. And no, they did not have cellular automata. No, they did not think in terms of point-to-point and second-to-by-second simulation. And they were the first ones to show emissions on the network by each car than anybody in academia.
I'm
an academic. I'm only from this family.
I agree with Howard that I think there was actually a lot going on already before transims. In particular, in terms of activity travel modeling, people were already talking about micro-simulation well before that.
Yeah.
In fact, as Ryuichi called it, the essay writing contest, I think Howard was involved in that, that the four groups that were commissioned to
by FHWA to say where the future is going to go, and everyone talked about microsimulation, took different approaches and so forth, and part of the shock was, I mean, the expectation was those groups thought they were going to get money to go up and, you know, do something, and then all the money went to Los Alamos. So, we were doing microsimulation, you know, in the 1980s, and so were you. No doubt.
But the misconception of our field is that when somebody new comes into play, it's perceived as a threat. I know for a fact that those $20 million that Transims got, that Lan got, was never going to come to transportation because the originator told me that. Right, Tom Larson, the poor guy is dead, but you know. And no, transportation field is existing. We lost money. We should have gotten them. The different major universities of the United States thought that's their money. It was never intended to be the money of transportation. And they criticized Lanham for no reason. Okay? And I was a graduate student when they told me that.
Okay. Really, this is now the discussion has become to talking about history. We don't want a discussion.
No.
Okay, well, John and Mark.
Different.
Thank you.
More to modeling framework and simulation frameworks. And the idea of modeling moment by moment or minute by minute, the types of models that are required in order to have a model that really dynamically depends on what's been emerging over time. And what I haven't heard talked about is the kind of data that's required in order to properly specify and estimate those kind of models. And this, to me, brings up the distinction between models of outcomes and models of process. And I know, Joshua, you've worked on this in your environment, and I would somehow like to hear this group talk a little bit about those types of issues, apart from software implementation, although I think they bear on software implementations, certainly. So if anybody would like to speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Joshua?
Yeah, those are very challenging data collection. Not quite the size I was hoping for, but it really, you know, collecting this type of process data, I think, is necessary for moving these types of dynamic models where you're looking at them, you know, the day changes, and sort of what we were saying with the impulsive activities. You can see what is the process that generates this, and how does that interact with the, you know, non-impulsive activities. So what was already planned in the schedule to do any realistic schedule adjustments in response to these unexpected delays and trips and things. We need this type of data.
But once you don't know where to draw the line, basically. Once you start collecting that kind of data, and then you started collecting actually processes data, how people came to that decision, how do they actually decided what went through their mind to make that decision, and then.
Data, but it's still sort of an outcome, we're seeing an outcome of a higher level consensus, and we put this level
down. Well, we were just talking about today, Peter mentioned about the basically integrating, bringing in the reliability into. Into the models, and then he mentioned that the traffic engineers, they're bringing reliability. They said, well, we're looking at reliability in link level, but then bringing into the route choice and actually in the route level, that's I was wondering, okay, wait a second, where can I get that data to look at the, you know, how reliable is actually the entire route, rather than, you know, in link I have loop detector data, traffic engineers, they have loop detector data, or just any cameras, things like that.
You have 2 weeks of alterations in our GPS plan. So maybe something,
maybe like GPS assisted multi-day surveys, they're still outcomes, but by virtue of, you know, repeated, you can infer certain things that relate to the process. The other approach which we tried, it's heavy, is to take the GPS survey and convert it into the prompted recall survey.
Yeah, that's what we did.
With you can also add some stated preference questions, including why did you do that and what would you do, things like that. It kind of worked, but it's not, I don't see actually a way to really get this information, you know, in a big survey. It's a problem. It's a problem.
It seems to me that we may be talking about an order of magnitude increase in complexity. Of the underlying modeling framework and maybe the models themselves, if we don't want to strap ourselves with a whole bunch of unrealistic assumptions about the process.
Of course, doing cell phone data collection these days, recording every event that happens on your cell phone. That location is available. Now the question is, how do you translate that into behavioral activities? If you can track that for months or whatever, a month, for the same cell phone ID, you get some concept of what that person is doing on a regular basis.
Oh, we have many of those data, but we can link that to person's attributes. Yeah. None of those data sets actually gives you any information.
But you don't have what they didn't choose, which I think is the problem.
You don't have the choice concept.
You can get lots of data about what people are actually doing, what they're experiencing, but you don't know what they're trading it off against.
Mark actually just for a long time just gives.
Well, a couple of things. One, Peter and I are the token modelers on a UNCHRB project, the geostats got on how to use GPS data in the future. So.
Well, so we are on that.
We're all on that.
Yeah, Josh and I are that.
How many in this room are on that project?
I'm on the panel.
Oh, you're on the panel.
Anybody else would be happy to take credit for your ideas.
It's GPS thing and not cell phone, right?
Yes.
Any kind of
data. Geographic data.
Yeah, but
I would just like mention, sometimes if we talk about history, sometimes models survive even if you don't have direct data to validate them, but the concept will healthy and you can validate them on aggregate. And the best example is the Waldrop user equilibrium, because when it was formulated in 50s, people didn't have it. So actually there's very limited number of route choice. So we don't know how people choose routes. So we never validated the Waldrop, but since you know traffic counts, whatever looks reasonable, the healthy concepts survive even without direct calibration. So might be like the hope, if you have a good behavioral mechanism, you can validate it based on the outcomes. And it's still a possible thing to do, because that's what happened, 40 years ago.
If it's I'm not sure exactly I see the distinction that you're necessarily referring to. I mean, to me, all of these models are based on outcomes data, but are trying to represent processes in play. So regardless of the econometric specifications or the rules that you're trying to incorporate, any set of models is trying to represent processes. If you're trying to model household interactions, intra-household interactions, and what people are doing with their kids or their spouses or their other household members, we're not necessarily observing all the thought processes going into that, and yet all of our models, whatever you want to call them, are trying to mimic those outcomes that we observe in the data. So I don't necessarily
I tell you where the difference is. When we design models and break them into pieces, you are right, we impose our own design. But at least at any point, we can generate the corresponding data set. What you are proposing, your models, you will never be able to do that, because you break it into parts, you schedule, those rules you will never even after imposing the structure and accepting, you will never be able to create a data set to validate it. That's a principal difference. Existing activity-based models that we develop, they allow you at least to validate each and every step.
There is no difference. Again, I don't see a distinction. Whatever you are producing as a result of your process, we are producing as a result of our process. Regardless of the point at which you are breaking it or observing the phenomenon.
we break it into parts. We have destination choice for work, car ownership.
We have the same.
Each of them. How can you validate this process if you...
We have the same. There's no difference. You take CellGap, SimAgent, OpenAMOS. We're doing destination choice. We're doing mode choice. We're doing departure time, activity duration.
Yeah, but you're forecasting, you're modeling the final outcome,
yeah.
Not the process went through to come to that final outcome.
So what do we work from in the models that I've been developing? We work with the household survey.
Yeah, that's exactly what we work with as well.
Okay, and there's no information in that household survey to say, what will I do, how will I change my mind for the next 15 minutes or for the next hour? Based on what's happened so far today. There just isn't information in those surveys on which to develop that.
How can even distinguish between, tell me, how distinguish between scheduling and rescheduling in a household survey?
That's what you have to ask. You have to survey.
No, but it's
well, if you start.
Survey companies take those questions up.
Yeah, survey companies take those
questions. But you don't even need to, we're not even worried about scheduling and rescheduling. All we're worried about is history dependency. Look at the literature. There are several papers that talk about history dependency within the day and how activity engagement towards the latter part of the day is influenced by what you have done until that point.
I agree with you, but I'm just saying that the data that we've been using does not carry that information.
Oh, yes, it does. Because you have activity engagement at every point of the day. You know what a person is doing. Maybe you don't know what they're specifically doing inside the home. But otherwise, you can construct a time of day profile for every person, and you can make that person's choice at any time point conditional on what they have done up to that point in the day. So that history dependency is well documented, and that's the kind of stuff that you will see incorporated in SunGap or OpenAMOS or any of these kind of continuous time models. And I would think Albatross is probably somewhat in that.
But there might be an infinite number of processes.
It does not take such a very clear structure. But I think it relates to another issue with respect to outcome models and process models, in the sense that if you're modeling the combined choice as an outcome, we're only representing data. And I have more favor in doing that as independently as we possibly can, and then use the outcome in an integrated sense, like you're saying, as a validation of the model. Because otherwise, the model is nothing more than a representation of the integrated output. So we're not trying even to separate the assumptions about the process versus the outcomes. And that is a major distinction, certainly with respect to Albatross.
And that
so
makes it policy sensitive.
We're not
basically
taking the integrated profiles as the target of our modeling process. We start with a assumed process model, and again, we're working on verifying that, and we're only using the integrated data as the ultimate test whether the process model will generate our observed integrated patterns. And I think that's an important difference from some of the other models, which take the overall outcomes and like in the nested logic structure, we trying to represent that. Then there's no process assumptions whatsoever. And that is a difference in approach. Although we're dealing with the same kind of data, and we are to some extent using the same concepts, but the process of validation is in the philosophy is quite different. So in methodological terms, there's a major difference between these two approaches.
But presumably, what most people who actually are the model users for are good predictions. So they want prediction tests that are out of sample and that are for real projects. And my personal belief is that there's a big difference between a model that you use for forecasting and one you use for description or explanation or understanding. And I would encourage all of you to build try to give us models that actually can predict what happens when something significant is done in the environment. And I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, all of us wind up working in the this field longer than we thought we would, probably. So I actually have reports that I wrote 20 years ago that said, this will happen when you do this. If I ever get the time, I'm really planning to go back and see how good or bad those report tests were.
Well, I haven't compared the activity-based model, any activity-based model, but I have I inherited the first travel forested travel development model developed for Chicago, the CATS model, in the 60s. I inherited that from David Boyce when I took up my office, actually, was right there. and I went actually and looked at the projections they had for 1980. And then I looked at the survey we had in Chicago in 1980, and the report is totally different. So forested models, you can't just rely on that. But activities, I haven't got back.
This is there are many different types of activity models. And people are encouraging you to build these kind of models because they want to know what will happen if they have a pricing policy. Or
that's the whole point of having, you know, this is an outcome model and a, you know, a process model, right? So the process model, if you can do it right, it should be able to be the same.
Well, that's it, you know, exactly. That's the difference. And the both of them, although it's going to give you the same outcome, because even process models, well, going through the process is going to generate the outcome that you have observed in your final, you know, because you're calibrating everything based on the data that you have observed, what was the final outcome. But it's more descriptive, and I would argue that it's more policy sensitive, that if you want to go and change all those.
But I don't care how you do it. I just want to know whether it predicts something in the future.
But there's no standard for actually testing that.
It is an assumption that the process model will generate a better forecast. I don't think we have a lot of hard evidence of the sort you're talking about yet. It's still
in some ways, there's very little data.
Yeah. Now, and just as a comment on the fourth step, just because the outcome is different than the prediction.
Well, many other.
The one study I'm aware of that tried to systematically look at this is the British, the TRRL, in the 80s, went back and looked at all the forecasts that were generated in the 60s for 20 years later. And they tried to do a fairly systematic assessment. And these were all four-step models. And they actually, as I recall, the one line conclusion was the four-step models themselves probably would have done a pretty good job if the population and employment forecasts had been completely wrong.
Sonny Conner actually did a similar study in the Portland area. I think he presented it at the Oregon Integrated Land Use Symposium that happened right before the Innovations Conference in 2008. All land use.
So,
many other factors actually are involved there. So, and we don't have much control for it. You're right.
So, anyway, I'm just saying it's not a simple question to say was the model
sure.
right.
We did a forecast for a project. I won't say it by name, but it was in Boston. It cost $15 billion. But some of the traffic forecasts we did actually came out pretty well. When I look at the assumptions we made, the assumptions are wrong.
We will never quote you on that. We will never tell anybody that.
That was a great model. It fixed all of the errors in
the
race.
Well, it's independent of all those inputs.
They got another feedback. That's why.
Come back to a comment Hani Ramasani made in the last one of these conferences 2 years ago. He said, we're not integrating our models, we're interfacing them. That still seems to be the case as far as I can see. Because I think a lot of the, especially for supply and demand models, that where things, to make them feasible, they're going to have to run really fast and transfer lots and lots and lots of information back and forth. I don't think it's going to work to interface models through files and things. I mean, you really need people have to start writing like DLLs, you know, bits of their code, that extracts of their processes that other people can use with their models or something like that.
Well, it's more than just using a DLL or just using a writing in a file and reading from a file. It just the models and decisions that are made by the agent should be integrated. So we are just in the demand side. We are just modeling, you know, travel time, the departure time, mode, destination, with whom those decisions are made in demand, and then in the supply side, we're just selecting actually the route the person takes, and the route is only depends on the the travel time in the network, and very much it has nothing to do with the many other factors that we're including in the demand side, all those sort of flexibilities that we are now including in the demand side.
It does. Because if your supply is also activity locations where you participate in activities.
Well,
it's directly linked to the land use model, because when you build scenarios and you move things around.
Well, that's an ideal situation, but right now we are not. We're just interfacing that.
But all of the destination choice are being done based on network conditions and network travel times.
I know, but the route I'm taking I know that where's my destination, which route I'm taking. That's totally independent of everything else. Even doing actually any of the actual models, I don't know. Just I don't care. I'm working with Transims. I'm working with actually Matsim. So any of these things you bring, it's totally different.
From the technical point of view, the word integration just means something very simple. At any point in time in the simulation, you can access each individual and get all the full information about this individual. Doesn't matter if it's a fully scheduled, which you then can reschedule, or if it's a part of a schedule which is already executed, produces delay, and then reschedule to the next thing. But you need to get access of all details, all the demographics, also social demographics, the household interaction, social network, if you want, and all that. It's just about access at any point in time.
Yeah,
and in this case, well, Ram presented an integrated model. That is one. The METSI model is an integrated model. You can stop it at any point in time, get the full information.
Oh, we have that. Yeah, what I mean is something else. We have surveyed people and that U-tracks data. We gave them GPS and then asked them.
But the agents in these models still persist through, you know, as a separate entity through the entire model stream. It's an integrated model. It's just sort of an aggregate way of choosing the problem.
Well, I'm just as an example, we did in the U-Track survey, we asked people, is that we saw the route they selected, and we asked them, why did you pick this route? And it's interesting to go and see actually that open-ended question, you know, just some elderly are scared of driving in expressways.
But are we
considering that in our route choice of the, when we are bringing those individuals, no agents, which are elderly, might be percentage of them are scared of taking expressways? Are we considering those who are trying actually to take 5 miles extra on the arterials because they want to avoid, you know, paying toll?
That's a question of how much information you pass back and forth.
That's
but,
one.
But the same basic point exists.
I mean, you could have logic-based route choice. So there's plenty of papers that actually have that, and logic-based route choice is based on socioeconomic characteristics of the choice maker. So there is some body of knowledge capable of integrating some of those factors into the right choice process. It's just that perhaps we haven't fully operationalized it in an integrated framework.
Well, I think
if you can access all of the information, as Michael was saying, you can very well do that.
Yeah, that's the point. We are basically these two parts, supply and demand, are developed independently.
Okay.
And we are basically, in fact, we are interfacing them no matter how hard we try. Is not real integration unless we are just going to bring in, actually develop everything in one, under one roof, with one.
I think the framework supported. It's just a matter of people mining the behaviors and then implementing it or operationalizing it.
But we need the reasoning why do we need this? Are we going to get better policy analysis out of the model?
That's exactly what it is.
We have to sell this idea, though.
Yeah.
Let's integrate. Okay, why? Is it going to be faster, better, smarter?
Faster.
Real
potential.
So one point is surely faster. It's about this, if you interchange information via data or via databases, it's horrible. So you have to do it in memory. So that's the point. So that's part of the integration, part of the advantage. The other thing is actually the policy studies itself. So I do not talk about how the behavior model looks like and how the correct utility function of measuring a daily plan looks like. Just assume there is one, What we can actually produce is to calibrate and validate the model, you actually estimate the parameter which are necessary for your function that reproduces the measured data. So counts, commuter sheds and things like that. So it just, you can reproduce the data you have. And the parameter gives you the description how different person groups behave, for example, for road pricing, for congestion charging and things like that. So that the man with the two kids avoid them, any kind of congestion charging, and businessman just drive through it. So you can reproduce those things. If it then produces a better or worse prediction model compared to others, I would say it's probably the same
that's
thing.
That's exactly why we need process data.
That's the point where process data is extremely important. Is, well, are the betas the correct one? And there you need additional data, which is not there. But from the conceptual point of view, that's the way you integrate models, and you can do exactly the same thing between transport and land use models. Okay, it's getting bigger and bigger, and you need more and more RAM. But it's the same idea. Just to get all kinds of information at any point of time during your simulation, and then you can actually work with it.
I would also characterize it, though, the supply-demand models need to be at the same general level, spatial and temporal resolution. And if they're not, I think we're really, that's why this integrated model is not working at the zone level or whatever, but they're not really looking at the problems at the same level.
But not only spatial temporal, but also typological. If demand model has hundreds of types of individuals' income, and in supply model you collapse all this into two income classes, it's also. So, but I would say something. If you think about differences between just iterative processes, naive things, let's run this, let's run that. There are millions. Those are all empirical things which you can play around all your life long and probably wouldn't lead anywhere. But if you think about real integration, that's a difficult thing to do. Mathematicians would say an integrated model, it's a model that can be written as a single optimization. There is something that mathematically creates integration. Our attempts to do these things with ABM and DTA, it just failed because both objects are just too complicated. You can do it with a four-step model and static assignment. There is a close mathematical definition with something which describes the integrated model. Still, you can decompose this model, and it would look exactly like it. You would run demand model, assignment, demand model, but you decompose it wisely. Mm-hmm. So it's still integrated model. So the fact that you run them in sequence now differs because you know what you are doing. You are trying to achieve an equilibrium state which is derived from the formulation. So we decided kind of to relax all this, at least empirically, and say, for me, integrated model is different from you, Michael, because it's not only access to information or the same level of resolution. For me, for example, like intuitive integrated model, if you achieve a full level of consistency at the individual level in terms of activities and trauma. And currently we are working, and this is some light along the temporal solution. So it means if travel time has to be accommodated with no gaps, no overlaps, impact on each other, at least show me this.
That was precisely the motivation behind this design.
Yeah, I see basically you're pursuing, maybe you don't formulate it this way, but what you're trying to do is the
but
same.
But what you're defining that formulation is exactly what David Boyce had done for a four-step model. He calls it combined model. Yeah.
Nothing of the sort. There's nothing of the sort, because four-step model doesn't have any activity.
I know. I'm just saying that
it's
the same concept, he defines everything in one big optimization problem.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with
including network.
It has nothing to do with that.
No.
It's a completely different concept. Okay. This concept failed. For our work, we have to formulate it in a different way.
For your comment before, I absolutely agree with you. You have to have complete consistency, which we have. Probably it's very wrongly formulated, or probably just the names of it is. What you put into the system are plans. So what you expect you could do. In the execution, you do something different. You have delays, like also Rem explained. And then the question is how you optimize. I do not talk about learning, how you optimize your daily activities to reach a relaxed state. So the way, the process to going to the relaxed state is not just, it's not explainable by learning, which was also done by a discussion before. It's not learning, it's optimization.
Yeah.
So during that optimization, you have inconsistency between the plans and the executed plans. Well, the executed plans can be a plan which is completely consistent with the traffic simulation and derived from the expected plan as an input for the simulation. So, but at the relaxed state, and you say that when you see the curves converting to each other, the produced new plans are extremely close to actually the execution of those newly produced plans because of the relaxation process. And there you're getting very near from the demand and the simulation. And the way there can be completely out of order, but that's no big deal because we're looking at the result at the end and not the process itself. So therefore, the complete consistency is absolutely crucial in the simulation, and the demand should be very, very similar to the execution at the end of the process. And for that, I completely agree with you.
Okay, I think now everybody's tired.
It's good to end on agreement.
So it was Josh, you want to have any final closing thing? Or? Excellent.
Thank you.